Hi, this is Dan.
And this is Sarah.
And we'd like to welcome you to PediPal,
a monthly podcast about all things pediatric palliative care.
The views in this podcast are ours alone, and they do not reflect the views of our respective institutions. They do not constitute medical advice.
Way to set a boundary between our podcast selves and our professional selves, Dan.
It's really important. And some boundaries are very clear. But to talk about the ways some of the other boundaries are a little bit more muddled, here are our guests.
My name is Stacey Remke. I'm a clinical social worker. I currently work at the University of Minnesota School of Social Work, where I teach MSW students. Prior to teaching, I worked way closer to 30 years than I like to think about it at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, and was one of the founders of the program there starting in the mid-90s. And so my career actually tracked the development of pediatric palliative care as a movement, let's say. And I love to talk about boundaries, so I'm excited about our conversation here.
Hi, my name is Bentley Stewart. I am a chaplain. I am in the midst of a transition. I am currently the chaplain of St. Joseph Children's Hospital in Tampa. And shortly after this is actually released, I will be back at Arnold Palmer Hospital for Children in Orlando. And there I'll be serving as the dedicated chaplain to the pediatric palliative care.
Stacey, you mentioned you teach MSW students and you love to talk about boundaries. And I'm thinking about how the concept of a boundary is first defined and how people first start to develop their own personal definitions of what a boundary is. And I'm wondering maybe for you or maybe for you, Bentley, if you could give us a textbook definition of a healthy boundary in clinical practice.
I always like to start with an analogy that a lot of people understand in healthcare, which is the idea of a semi-permeable boundary where things flow back and forth and osmosis occurs naturally and spontaneously. In my training, we learned about boundaries as a function of family systems in particular. And in between human beings, there's spontaneous flows of energy and identification and processes that occur amongst human beings, especially in families. And to appreciate that within families, it's helpful to distinguish between the individual members that make up the family as well as the family structure as a whole. So there's this sort of idea of these concentric circles almost, like the individual is its own entity and then it's in relationship with a kind of smaller number as a family, and then there's kind of larger boundaries that start to get developed between the family and the school community, for example, or the neighborhood, or those semi-permeable membranes where information comes in and information goes out. And then, you know, as we think about it in healthcare, you can start to see how those concentric circles and the intensity of encounters in palliative care apply pressure to some of those boundaries.
Stacey, I really appreciated that you grounded us in our bodies first, the organisms that we are. That just reminds me that boundaries are really about where do I begin and end?
Yeah.
And where do you begin and end? And a boundary is something that offers space between the two so that I don't over-identify with you and become enmeshed in you and can still be in service of you. Because when we're talking in a clinical setting, there's an asymmetry of power, right? And we're dealing with vulnerable populations.
Right out of college, I worked in a psych unit in Boston. It was a state hospital. And I had these really great mentors. And I remember one person telling me that when someone's in an extreme state, for example, florid psychosis with schizophrenia, and their sense of their body is really kind of distorted, and you're doing a lot of like psychological intimacy, you know, you're kind of talking to them and trying to help them ground and stuff. It's a good idea to not also essentially invade their physical space and vice versa. If you're doing a lot of physical contact, like the nurses on the psych unit did, you know, it would be good for them to give the person a lot of choice about the amount of emotional and psychological engagement that they had with that person. So that really always stuck with me as a good reminder that we all have our own sense of personal space. And then you just kind of add to that the idea of agency that children don't really have. to set personal boundaries. And part of that's developmental. When they're little, we do everything for them. And eventually over time, they develop into more autonomous human beings. And I think it's one of the most graceful things in parenting when people figure out how to help their child develop boundaries. That idea that children are vulnerable, and especially in palliative care when they're seriously ill, I think that bears thinking about.
I love that you bring up the vulnerability of a child. You know, I've knocked on the patient's room, that child's room. They didn't necessarily call for me to come at that moment. And I want to give them the opportunity to say, no, now's not a good time, and give them a little bit of power back and exercise some agency. Because unlike the nurse that has to run some labs or something, they can refuse spiritual care at any time. Being refused is an act of spiritual agency. And so it is a way of providing spiritual care. I just think agency is so important.
I just wanted to chime in with another important lesson I learned from my child life colleagues back in the day about, you know, how common it is for people who've maybe just seen a child go through a really difficult procedure and who's upset, and they say, can I have a hug? You know, the doctor or the nurse, instead of saying to the child, can I give you a hug? You know, the child in that instance is the most vulnerable element in the system of care. And so to ask that vulnerable element to kind of take responsibility, I think is a problem. And fortunately, I think we're learning as a pediatric community to do better about that. But I think to your point, Bentley, about like all the little places where we have the opportunity to ask permission, give children anticipatory guidance of what's going to happen, to prepare them to cope, I think those are all actually boundary issues at their core. When we recognize that the range of experience they might have, their choices in the matter might be limited, to think about how we prepare children actually and coach their families and how to support them in exercising appropriate boundaries when they're able to. When we need to overwhelm their boundaries, for example, if they need a lumbar puncture, that we do that with intention and also kind of address that boundary issue in there.
One of the things I want to point out in what you both are saying, we are talking about many different types of boundaries in the same breath. It's reminding me of how we talk about total pain. We talk about physical pain, spiritual pain, emotional pain, psychological pain, all of these things. They're all pain and they all interact with each other. Boundaries, physical boundaries, emotional boundaries, spiritual boundaries, they're not so separate from each other.
I would agree with that. And I think there's probably some crazy multidimensional diagram we could try and draw. It's a complex system in and of itself, in the sense that there's so many intersecting, interacting elements. You know, I was kind of joking before about being a boundary narc, but, you know, I really did get very protective about patients and families. And that was driven by some of the experiences I had and seeing how people were not attending to those and were doing harm. You know, kind of back to Bentley's earlier point, the parents that had a child that needed ICU level of care at home, and the perception that the family wasn't doing enough to prepare for that. And then gradually the parents got the nonverbal signals that they weren't welcome there and, you know, stopped coming. And then this isn't a good family for this child and we better go find another one. And hey, this nurse over here would be a great foster parent. You know, I mean, those kinds of issues that I'm glad to see you looking shocked, because it happened. It really happened. I think those kind of things happen all the time. The power imbalance is such that we need to be extra careful.
This conversation started with your definition of boundaries being family-based. And what I'm hearing you say, I have also noticed in practice, is sometimes we become family in a way that does harm to these patients.
Exactly.
Either we try and replace family, as unfortunately I think I heard a couple of examples of. Sometimes we become too close. How do we know when we have done harm? And how do we know when we have become too much family?
I really like that question. And I think in some way it ties to Dan's noticing of the multiple dimensions of pain. Like, I want to think, is there pain receptors? Are there boundary receptors that let us know we're coming up towards a line, a boundary that shouldn't be crossed? And I think, unfortunately, we often don't know we did harm until someone invites us to take a deeper look at our own behavior, until we get feedback. So I think oftentimes I can collude with my own narrative of how I'm a good person. And I'm doing this out of deep love for this family. And as a spiritual person, I want to reclaim the idea that it is okay to say we love our families. I want to reclaim that, but like how we do that and the appropriate expression of it needs to be important.
I think the first step is like being aware that that happens, that there are times when we overstep and might need to correct it, might need to say, oh, I might have jumped in there in a way that wasn't welcome. But that's part of what's daunting about thinking about this, because it does kind of implicate our practice in so many different directions. It's like how we manage ourselves. We can't always control how we are coming across to other people in spite of our best intentions. It's very hard to know where someone's personal boundaries live until you bump into them, until you override them. And I think that's one of the big challenges here is like, how do we create a culture in our healthcare environment where we create enough space for families and patients to let us know who they are and where their boundaries live, to be aware of our own tendency because of our comfort level in our own environment of the hospital or whatever, to sort of jump in and do stuff when actually stepping back and taking some time to like make sure family's kind of with us there, or that they understand why we're doing it, or, you know, even just some of those kind of simple steps that kind of recognize that they may not have the same experience as us, the same comfort level as us, same comfort level with engaging with their seriously ill child or doctors and nurses. All of those become boundary issues that work both ways. They can be extra rigid or they can be too soft. How does that work in an interdisciplinary team, interprofessional team? So again, these things reverberate in many different directions.
I'm wondering what that has looked like for teams that you have been on and what your experience with that concept has been, different boundaries for different team members.
When you're writing a manuscript, actually writing on a piece of paper, you have a margin and you don't want to go into the margin. And so at some point you have to stop or you're going to write off the page. But then you have that one long word and you're like, can I fit that word in? Or am I going to have to hyphenate it? Or do I just go to the next line and not fit it? And then there's this weird space there. Sometimes boundaries, because we don't know, families are so unique. And even the individuals within a family are their own interpreters of their family culture and their family system. So we don't know where boundaries are sometimes. And so it's easier to have space and be invited in than to transgress space that was never consented. I do think that our professions have different lineages. I've learned so much from our mental health professionals in the hospital. They are really grounded in the 50-minute therapeutic hour. This is a container. We're in this office. We've agreed to meet at this time. And these are the things we're going to work on. And it's extremely vulnerable, but almost never is there like anything more than a handshake. Going back to Stacey's earlier comment of like, while a nurse is very much very intimate with someone's physical body, doing physical body and psychosocial intimacy at the same time is probably too much to still call yourself a professional caregiver. And so I think that's partly why I think our disciplines get different fields we get to operate in. And I don't know that it's clear to say this is what this is and this is what that is. Different people, and this is more individuals within professions, have different feelings about how bereavement support should go. Do we go to the funeral? Do we do follow-up calls? If so, how many and for how long?
I think you're getting at something that's important too, which is practitioners are entitled to boundaries as well. Whether it's turning your, you don't have pages anymore really, do we? Cell phone off on the weekend, not giving your personal cell phone to your patient and family. You know, some people would see that as being kind of harsh and mean. Other people would see it as being protective of the practitioner over time. If you have 100 families calling you over a couple of years, that's a lot of time and energy where you're not able to claim your own space, your own boundary, be with your family, you know, do fun things, whatever. I know for me, a personal boundary became going to funerals. Like there came a point where there would be dozens of funerals a year of patients. And at some point, I just had been to enough children's funerals and it became important for me personally just to be able to give myself permission to not go. I would write a card, I would call them later, I would do something else. And then every once in a while, I just felt like I needed a funeral and I would go to one. But, you know, but I think we all need to kind of find that place for ourselves as well. Because if you think about palliative care practitioners of all stripes, you know, we're a limited resource and a highly skilled resource. And how do we protect that as well? Because these are families whose needs are very compelling. It feels better to families, I think, to open their boundaries and have us come in as sort of extensions of family. I think that feels better. But then that creates other kinds of problems. Like, you don't answer the phone on the weekend and they thought you would because you were, you know, a special person to them or whatever.
You all have been in many palliative teams, so I know you've undoubtedly run across some chaplain reading Mary Oliver to you at some point. So you're probably familiar with the classic line. What is it that you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? I hope all of us and all of our listeners, as we're tending to these precious lives, that we're doing our own quality of life analysis, whether it's the ancient buzzword of self-care or whatever you want to call it, doing the things that tend to our well-being, our souls, our families, our friends, the relationships and projects that give our life meaning and fulfillment. It is our humanity that we offer these people in crisis. These boundaries are very much in service of ourselves, as much as they are in service of the family and in service of other families, so that there's something of me left to give another time.
It feels so much like healthy boundaries are the key to longevity in this practice.
You know, that could be a whole nother podcast of longevity in the field and resilience. And I've been looking into that myself. And I had my own story about that too, when I did break and, you know, was able to kind of figure out how to come back. And I think one of the things that really was important for me as I learned a meditation practice that actually gave me a way to visualize separating at the end of an encounter. So returning the person's energy back to them with love and drawing my own back to me again. And I can do that in my own mind. Nobody knows I'm doing it. It's like a little kind of mantra. It feels like it fits with my worldview about how boundaries and systems work. And it's just been immensely helpful to me as a practice. Even within our own healthcare environment, palliative care people are seen as sort of other and over there. So I think all of these are interesting boundaries to think about. How do we protect ourselves without cutting ourselves off? How do we make ourselves available? What are some of the daily practices that we can do to sustain ourselves? And how do we recover from that exposure? Do I take my vacation time? Do I take a long weekend once a month? But I think, again, it all starts with being aware that these boundaries are important. The pain in those families is so great. It's very understandable that we go rushing forward to try and spare them that or save them from it somehow, as if we could. And so to appreciate that we can't spare them that suffering, but we can be present, that container that Bentley talked about earlier can be reassuring at a time when people's own boundaries are being tested just by their situation.
I do think that pediatric palliative care practitioners come to the work with such earnest desire to help that they are at risk for having terrible boundaries. What is it about pediatric palliative care that makes it such a hard place to have these boundaries? Because I don't know that I hear oncologists talk about this in the same way, and I don't know that I hear other specialists and other fields talk about it in the same amount of intentionality and depth that I do in pediatric palliative care.
I kind of wish I did see other disciplines talk about it more.
Yeah.
So I'd want to begin there. I want to reframe struggle. I do think we struggle with it, but I think we all should be struggling with boundaries. That's me thinking and being critical of our practice. So I think the struggle is good, and we struggle because we're aware of it. We're brushing up against finitude every day. We're reframing hopes. Those are boundaries. Everything we are doing is touching boundaries. To do it well, to do it with precision, means we're being thoughtful. And so it's a struggle.
Those of us who've been drawn into this work, we want to help. As you said, you know, we want to relieve them of some of that if we can. But I think the way to do that is actually to respect the boundaries that are inherent in the situation, that are inevitable. And that also part of that is having confidence that the family and their children have what they need to survive this. Rather than trying to rescue people from suffering, although I will say for you doctors, I'm so grateful for all the expertise in pain and symptom management and the role we all play in that. But, you know, to think about how we reframe it a bit, and that good boundaries actually reinforce the integrity of the family and their capacity to weather what they need to with our help. We see ourselves as helpers instead of rescuers, I think, savers. I don't know a lot of people who think of themselves consciously that way, although sometimes they act as if they were thinking that way, if that makes sense. Little kids are very compelling.
That word, Stacey, that you just used, compelling, is such an important word in this context, right? Because there is a compulsion, there is a draw to intimacy, to compassion, right? Suffering with. You are pulled to it. And maybe that's our self-selected group of people who have already been compelled to do this work. But, you know, speaking for myself, and I think speaking for the experiences of others that I've heard, it's both fundamental to the work, like it's how we're taught to do the work in some ways, but it's also like an emotional tug. You see a child who is having an uncomfortable experience, and there's just something so human about wanting to comfort them. But as we've discussed through this whole episode, there are ways that you do that that will be helpful, and there are ways that you do that which will be more harmful.
I have a really crass and terrible analogy. So we may have to cut this off the air, the definition of pornography. Somebody said, you probably remember this, they were asked to describe it, and they just said, I know it when I see it. And I feel like that's, in a way, how I think about boundary violations. It's really hard to describe, but I know it when I see it. But that makes it really hard to teach, and that makes it really hard to give feedback on, because I might know it when I see it, but the person who I'm trying to talk to about it may not.
Because they have a different boundary.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I mean, you see it, but also you feel it in your gut, or you kind of cringe, or I mean, there are a lot of signals that people get about those boundary infractions. And maybe that's part of it, is we could build that into our team discussions somehow. Like, how do we know individually and collectively when we're bumping into somebody's boundaries?
I was thinking about the word compelling as well. And I like that better than the word I've used in other settings. So I'm going to switch my language, because before I often talk about, there's something about boundaries that are seductive. There's energy there and we're drawn to transgress. I mean, even at a cognitive level, do not think of a pink elephant. And you're probably thinking of a pink elephant right now. And so when we set up these things that we shouldn't do, and yet we know we're drawn to, it creates a really rough feedback loop. Going back also to what you said, Dan, of wanting to comfort, I think of the simple ways in rooms that I've been in where making sure the tissues are available versus the clinician who just wraps their arms around the mom, and then suddenly the sobbing stops because their grieving was shut down. And that's a physical boundary that so clearly short-circuited the emotional journey they needed to go through. That's the thing I really appreciated about what you said, Stacey. We're wanting this family to have a journey beyond this hospital. Wherever their kid's life journey goes, we want this family to continue. And we don't have the ability to be with all of these families. They're going to have their journeys without us. And we want their time with us to have enriched them with skills to do that well.
So Dan, tell me, what do you think our take-home points from this episode are?
There are so many, and this episode actually got me thinking so much. It's hard for me to distill down to a few take-home points here. One of the main things that is sticking with me is that there seem to be two important axes on which we project our boundaries, or which help us think about boundaries: intimacy and power. And I think those two axes are important in basically all of our interactions in pediatric palliative care and in healthcare more generally. And the boundaries that we create or enforce circumscribe the intimacy and the power in our relationships with each other, and try to keep the intimacy and the power in appropriate proportions.
We went into planning this episode and thinking about this topic with, I think I had a personal hope to have a clearer definition or a clearer look at what that line looks like. And I wonder if, as you're saying, the fact that there are multiple axes amongst which this topic moves and shifts, it's one of the reasons it's really hard to draw a definitive boundary. It's really hard to think what is a boundary in a way that you can teach somebody without them sort of going and doing a little bit of that push-pull themselves and trying to figure it out on their own.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's all dynamic. And I keep coming back also to that metaphor that Stacey started with of the semi-permeable membrane. And how, like, you get dynamic equilibrium, not because everything is like clearly on one side and the other side. It's always moving back and forth. Depending on the conditions on either side, that boundary can shift where its equilibrium point is. So, like, I don't know if we can come up with good concrete definitions here or good concrete rules for where the boundaries should be, because it's going to be different with every individual person and every different encounter they're having with any other person. And this is getting really deeply philosophical into some like territory that I'm not equipped to go into.
Well, I mean, I think we always love when we end a topic with more questions than we started. And this feels like one of those topics.
Absolutely.
So hopefully part two, part three, part four down the line, we can revisit. Thanks for listening. Our theme song is provided by Kevin McLeod. You can follow us on Twitter, where our username is @PDPal. You can find the notes for this podcast and all of our episodes on PDPal.org. If you'd like to submit thoughts, objections, or ideas for future episodes, please reach out via the email on our website. This has been PDPal. We'll see you next month.
We have to remember to try and say something funny about boundaries to put at the end of the episode, because we haven't yet.
Maybe this is the topic there is nothing funny to say about, and maybe we just put that line you just said at the end.
What's funny about boundaries? Nothing. Okay.